Brilliant. Okay, so if I put that over here.
Sure.
Hopefully, we never quite know about the range of this device, but anyway. Well, I'm delighted to have Matthew with us. I think particularly appropriate today, because I've got my Significance magazine, and a lot of them about crying and possible injury could well occur. Matthew from the Institute of Criminology, and he's going to be talking about the algorithm is going to get you, should we fear the rise of artificial intelligence in criminal justice. Matthew.
Thank you. I'll try and stay behind the lectern so that the audio is consistent for whoever's going to listen to this, but it's not because I'm trying to be impersonal. Thank you very much for inviting me to come and speak, Peter, and I hope you find this interesting. Please ask me any questions that you want to as we go along. Don't be afraid to interrupt me, you won't throw me off. I'm very excited, particularly because I got to use the Chiller font for the first time ever in a history of presentations that I've written. And one of the pervading themes of what I want to talk to you about today is this culture of fear in the presentation of use of algorithms that's about in the media at the moment. And I'm going to try and address that from an aspect that justifies it, perhaps, and the defence that many law enforcement agencies are picking up. And I think there is a real need to sort of address this question about whether we should be afraid of the rise of artificial intelligence or algorithmic computation in law enforcement strategies. So I'm going to do that through the course. This is just the abstract recycled. I'm going to do this through the course of about 40 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes. First of all, by just sort of setting the context for policing and now I'll make an advance apology. If I say anything and you think I have no idea what he's talking about, it means I've lapsed into policing jargon and policing nomenclature, so please pull me up on that straight away and I'll try to explain what I mean. But I want to just sort of paint the picture of the sort of environment that policing in particular is operating in this country at the moment, and then talk about how they're starting to address the opportunities that artificial intelligence, advanced maths, machine learning are starting to present for law enforcement agencies. And then I'm going to go into a couple of specific examples that I have personal experience of, just to illustrate how some of those things are being applied at the moment. That bit's not going to get overly technical, but I will show some stats at that point, and we can talk through those. And then I'll just sort of raise a few sort of semi-rhetorical questions after that for debate and discussion for as long as you want. A bit about me, just to introduce myself. I'm affiliated to Cambridge University in a couple of different ways. I'm a current PhD candidate at the Institute of Criminology, where I first started studying there about 6 years ago as a Master of Studies student. All part-time, so all done alongside working full-time in policing. Not as a police officer, I've never arrested anybody, I've never pepper-sprayed anybody that I know of, but as a civilian member of staff and particularly in crime analysis for most of that career. So I left that last summer to work for the research company of my professor at the Institute of Criminology. And now I'm doing much more interesting things than I was when I was on the inside of policing, because now I'm less focused on the bureaucracy of people management, the administrative side, and much more focused on the application and development of tools like the type that I'm going to talk about. My specialism, I suppose if I was going to pick an area of criminology to say that I specialise in, it's probably domestic abuse, although through my professional career in policing, I'm more of an eclectic, I go across multi-disciplines. Definitely quantitative stuff is my favourite angle, but I'm not a trained statistician, so there is more than a little part of me that's a bit daunted coming to speak to a statistical discussion group. But fear that you'll find me out that I don't know what I'm talking about, but let's see if I can bluff my way through it. I just want to sketch out at the outset some of the headlines that have been in the media relatively recently, some of them up to up to and including this week, and they're all almost universally negative or looking to exploit people's uncertainties around the bad side or the possible negative sides of artificial intelligence and algorithms. And I'm going to touch later upon the distinction between the two in this context, but for now I'm just going to lump them all in as one sort of term. So on the mild side, you have criticisms such as this one, sort of saying, yes, police forces are starting to deal more with this sort of tool, but transparency of these is not keeping up. And it's particularly true of black box methodologies, where the actual mathematical side of it is hidden away from the end user. And of course, that's an inherent problem with some of these things, because they are incredibly complex, they process huge amounts of data with lots of variables, and transparency is not the most easy thing to access. There was a court ruling in the United States in the recent past where a judge threw out an appeal based upon a defendant challenging their sentence because it was informed by a black box algorithm, and the courts in America decided to take the position that that is legitimate and they would support that sentence. It hasn't happened yet in this country, and there are less practical examples of that type of tool leading to specific justice outcomes, but it's only a matter of time. So some of these questions are going to come up time and time again, and transparency is up there at the forefront. Once you sort of drill past the transparency aspect, and some of the use of these tools, it is analysable, and police forces through ethics committees and public advisory groups are attempting to make efforts to consult with people as much as you can in terms of the type of specialist functions that we're talking about. But that's being met with a lot of uncertainty and challenge around the potential for bias being introduced into these types of tools. Now, obviously, at this stage, I'm talking about very generic use of algorithms and artificial intelligence. Later on, I'll drill down into specific examples, and we can sort of look at these lenses through those examples. But this theme of bias, it will be returned to again in later parts of the presentation. The main seat of this criticism is that by using this sort of Bayesian principles of the past will help us to predict the future, we are cementing existing biases that are already in some of these processes. So if, for example, black and minority ethnic communities are being disproportionately stopped and searched for potential carrying of offensive weapons, then constructing an algorithm to help you identify potential targets based upon who's been successfully stopped in the past might exacerbate that disproportionality if it is indeed illegitimate. There's so many if, buts and maybes in any of these contexts, but this is a real obstacle for the use of this type of tool to overcome in law enforcement. The US is a big purveyor of this type of tool. In Philadelphia in particular, the work of Professor Richard Burke, they are really sort of advancing in an applied way with the Philadelphia Police Department the operational use of some of these tools. And they are coming under fire. You know, academia is a cutthroat world at times, and it's not beyond feasibility that some university researchers will attack some of the products of others, and that's happening in some of these examples in the United States already, where the legitimacy of the tools is being thrown into question through evidence to challenge from other areas. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but this obviously is part of the overall evolution of these sorts of tools, and keeping public trust being an important element of it. This again is another real challenge. We've recently, this sort of tool comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and I'm not going to talk particularly much about facial recognition tools, which are very sort of next generation for where law enforcement in this country's use of artificial intelligence is at the moment. But you have the sort of big tech giants, and again, this is very recently, sort of coming together and calling upon Amazon not to sell this stuff to law enforcement agencies because they are concerned about the lack of regulation on it. They're probably also concerned about the bottom line somewhere there as well, but that is a real challenge for police forces trying to use algorithms. They aren't regulated in any central way, and it's something that even the Home Affairs Select Committee has picked up on already in this country by holding meetings and publishing a paper on the sort of regulation of this sort of tool. And this is starting to set, I think quite appropriately, a high bar for how these tools are applied. I think the sharpest criticism so far has been this one from a group called Liberty, you may or may not have heard of, a sort of civil rights campaigning group, published a report earlier this year called Policing by Machine. And it's perhaps quite difficult to objectively assess this from the inside as a practitioner and somebody who writes these sorts of tools and understands the endeavour that can go into them from behind the scenes. This report is scathing. This made national press and doesn't stop short of calling for all of these initiatives to be banned. And there are more than two dozen police forces actively engaged in this country. There are 43 geographical police forces in this country, and the railway police. More than half of them are now engaged in either trialling or actively applying in the field different types of tools of this regard. So if this were followed through on, and while their report, I think their report has some holes in it, there's certainly a wind of momentum with them. That would put a huge dent in some of the current policing strategies that are out there. All okay with me so far? So I want to put a little bit of context on this, just to talk about why police forces are even looking, because it's obviously a hot potato. Any chief constable who is putting one of these tools into the field is potentially staring down the barrel of the Mail on Sunday, bringing them up and asking them some searching questions. And that is a real fear for a lot of chief constables. That's quite right. Yeah, every force has a chief constable by law, and they are kind of the sheriff of that neighbourhood, if you like. So there is a chief constable of Cambridge. The exceptions are metropolitan police forces who might have a commissioner who is sort of a super chief constable, if you like, just above that. And they are distinct from police and crime commissioners, which you may have heard of, who are elected officials, but they don't control the operations of policing. They aren't a police officer. They control the budget, how much money comes from council tax, etc., etc. But chief constables are ultimately responsible for the operations. If it all goes wrong, it's the police, it's on the chief constables, on the chief constable's shoulders. And they're increasingly taking, if we view this as taking a risk, and you may all have different views from your own fields about whether this is actually a risk or not, or whether this is just a no-brainer, the technology is there, why wouldn't you use it? It's coming from an increasingly hot, burning platform around decreasing resources and increasing demand. So this chart stops short of more recent data, which is available, so I apologise for that, but it tells a story I'm looking to tell. Since 2010, the funding that the police gets, which comes mainly from central government but also partially from council tax bills in this country, and there are some other special grants that police forces will get, so the Metropolitan Police Force will get royalty protection, etc., etc. They've all been diminishing across the board, and by large amounts. So some police forces are estimating that they have 20 25% fewer police officers and civilian staff than they had nearly a decade ago. So they are having to look, even if we sort of think that demand has stayed flat, which I'll show you it hasn't in a minute, they will have to find new ways of dealing with some of their challenges. That obviously is just the money. Most of the money that the police take in is spent on people, and police officers are, you know, when the police forces in this country consult with the public, or when the government pays Ipsos Mori to go and consult with the public, a uniformed, visible policing presence in the community is, if not always, very close to the majority of the time, the top priority for the communities that are consulted. So frontline policing officers, which might not necessarily be somebody who has a high visibility jacket on, they might be a detective in plain clothes, those are often seen as a key indicator of the sort of capacity and general health of the police service. This obviously goes into a more recent period, and again, it tells a story which isn't surprising when you take that funding into context, but it puts into sharp relief the extent to which there are fewer police officers now, fewer people to go out and arrest, fewer people to develop intelligence, fewer people to work on crime prevention, problem-solving initiatives with communities. And that is taking its toll. This is a common narrative that many policing bodies will be constantly putting out, and it can come over as not a little apolitical. It can come over as an attack on the government, particularly that the Prime Minister was the Home Secretary, and there's bad blood between the Policing Federation and the Prime Minister from when she was Home Secretary. But the statistics of this tell a real story that police officers available to do things, there are many fewer now than there were in 2010. Meanwhile, crime, recorded crime, and this is a really simplistic graph, and recorded crime is not a simplistic topic, but you'll indulge me just by paraphrasing for this. Police recorded crime, the crime that goes into police forces and goes on the books and is therefore investigated, has been sharply rising since 2013. Now, that runs contrary to the Crime Survey for England and Wales, which is a telephone and face-to-face survey with individuals from every police jurisdiction that measures the crimes that actually happened. So there is an acknowledged gap between assaults, thefts that actually happen to individuals in this country and those that actually get reported to the police. And in the crime survey, you're called up and you're asked about the types of things that have happened to you in the last 12 months, irrespective of whether you reported it to the police. The gap that the crime survey shows a very flat to slightly declining trend in overall crime, whereas police recorded crime, as you can see there, has taken a sharp upturn, and that coincides with a change in policy from the government and the body that inspects the police, which is called Her Majesty's Inspector of Police, Fire and Rescue Services, which is now a mouthful, where they have been increasingly putting pressure on police forces to get their house in order around their record keeping. So traditionally, you would find that a disturbance in a neighbourhood would be called in by a member of the public and recorded by the police as something we call antisocial behaviour. It's not a breach of the law, it's not a criminal offence, nobody's taking to court for antisocial behaviour. But strictly speaking, under the definition of the law, that crime could be conceived as a public order offence. It's a breach of the peace, and it should have been classified as a recordable crime. So the implications between the two, the distinction between the two, is important, because the police weren't investigating antisocial behaviour incidents. They weren't reported in their justice statistics, so they were never going to get charges or court prosecutions for those. They are good, when those are classified as public order crimes, they go into the full remit there, and they are expected to go and investigate like they would for any other criminal offence. So this is having a it's having an inverse effect. There's real attrition between the shrinking of the available capacity these organisations have and the demands that are coming in. And this is just crime. I'm now going to show you a slide, which I apologise for before I put it up, because you won't be able to read it, but hopefully I'll be able to talk you through it. There is an increasing trend among police forces in this country to try to understand their demand beyond just recorded crime. And it's worth my while just illustrating some of the types of that demand, just to contextualise some of the use of the tools that we're going to talk about. There is a big chunk of demand from what is collectively labelled safeguarding. Let me try and find it up on here. This will come in the sort of shape of either missing persons, which I think are over here, or referrals for child or vulnerable adult protection. So I'm concerned about this lady who has dementia. How could you go and visit her and put a plan in place with adult social care services to help safeguard her from anything happening? Or I'm concerned about this child, they've turned up at school for the third time without being fed, we're concerned about child neglect. Now, traditionally, those types of case would perhaps go into social services or child protection services, which are often managed under the auspices of a local council. And those bodies are still involved, but increasingly there is a prerogative for police forces to be at the table and even taking primacy on some of the responses to those calls for action. And that's come from cases like the Baby P case, which was a very high profile case about a young baby called Peter who was murdered by his father, I think, despite repeated contacts from multiple government agencies who weren't talking to each other, weren't sharing that information, and therefore took no action. So the response to that has been to increase the responsibility on all of these agencies, but under a collective safeguarding responsibility. So these aren't necessarily crimes, and in most cases they find no crime. They're about protecting individuals, from vulnerable individuals, from a crime happening further in time. Does that make sense? There are also demands around missing persons, road traffic act collisions, antisocial behaviour is still very much a real thing, and so on and so forth. And a lot of these things are starting to, particularly in the safeguarding arena, where some of those other partner agencies have suffered themselves from resource contraction, the demand is still there and still a challenge for police forces. So naturally you're starting to see a case for, well, if there's this new technology or new form of machine learning that's out there, could we not employ it to utilise our resources a bit better? Are there any questions at this point? No? Okay.
I know we were talking earlier about people being protected off their patches. We hope it'd be nice, you know. I mean, with this Peter, this young, there was all these agents involved, but they don't always communicate perhaps with one another, and perhaps if you have this technology, they might be able to feed into it and be a central hook, which might make things more effective.
Yeah, there's loads of reasons. It's incredibly complex, and it's easy to say, to point the finger and say these agencies don't share information, but of course in practice there are lots of barriers, cultural and legal as well. You know, data sharing has been, data protection, data sharing has been a major obstacle and makes agencies nervous about sharing personalised information. And I think a lot of good's been done to try and overcome some of those things. But in the the other thing is, as they turned over the stones, they found more. They have made progress in sharing information, but that progress has generated more demand because it's become more acceptable and more normal to identify and deal with cases that they previously weren't doing. And there's a bit of risk aversion there as well, but it's police forces, you know, whereas 15 years ago, the what they call the public protection staff in police agencies, which manage your sex offenders who live in the community, they'll go and visit them and make sure they're keeping to their conditions. They've exploded into multifaceted department with child protection teams who deal with child sexual exploitation cases, with vulnerable adult teams who work almost exclusively in care homes, and domestic abuse, which I'll talk about in more detail, which is now, you know, a much higher profile type of crime than it was 10, 15 years ago. And that has to be dealt with, rightly so, that has to be dealt with, but comes at a resource cost. And the standard, you know, so the standard model of policing in this country, as well as internationally, has typically organised around these three structures. Random patrol, police officer comes on to shift, maybe briefs themselves on what's been going on in the last 24 hours, heads off out to where they feel they should go and patrol, if they're not doing something else that's in the office, of course. Rapid response, so if there's an emergency, get to it as quick as possible. And reactive investigation, so when crimes are reported to the police, put in place a response to that. Not necessarily anything wrong with two of those random patrol. Are, you know, we could challenge, and there's quite a big evidence base around saying that actually that should be targeted. But the other two are fairly central tenets of policing now. But since probably the latter mid part of the last decade, there has been a move to try to create more science in policing approaches, and that sort of encapsulated by this term evidence-based policing, which steals its moniker from evidence-based medicine or evidence-based management, deliberately so, really, for brand awareness. And this is coined by a professor at the Institute of Criminology, Lawrence Sherman. I think you said Lawrence had been to talk to you before.
Yes, that's
right. Yeah. This is evidence-based policing sort of grew out of experimental criminology, but has sort of broadened its horizons. And the way this is described now is in these three strands. This sort of the targeting of resources, using of evidence, and I use that in the broadest possible sense, evidence, to target these scarcer resources to where they're going to make the most difference, which is certainly, you know, the most powerful units, so the places where the problems or the most harmful problems are occurring, or the people who are causing the most damage to communities, or the times when bad things are happening. But trying to be more rigorous and systematic about developing approaches to target those resources. And then when you go to target them, what you're doing when you're there or with that person is using tried and tested, and that is tested in the experimental sense, interventions. So there is an increasing movement in policing, way behind the medical profession, but to run randomised control trials on policing interventions. Hotspot policing is one of the biggest, or one of the deepest evidence bases in that respect, where over the last three decades, numerous RCTs have been run that show pretty conclusively that if you target police officers into areas with the highest crime at the highest time, you will have a suppressive effect on crime, and you will increase community satisfaction. Now, that seems like common sense, right? But that, up until this point, wasn't evidence and wasn't what police were doing. They were going out and patrolling wherever they wanted to patrol. But even now in 2019, with a dozen, 15 RCTs and a systematic review that says hotspot policing works, it's not still not bread and butter for police forces. So this is a fledgling discipline in policing, but it's starting to bleed through. And in the third strand of tracking, there's some advocacy for trying to exploit modern technology, modern business intelligence platforms, data capture, GPS, to try to track how the targeting and testing strands are working. This is just a framework, a broad framework, but it kind of encapsulates the evidence-based policing movement. And it's firmly within this sort of context that the rise of artificial intelligence and algorithmic-based policing has emerged. Looking more broadly, policing is aspires to be a profession and is trying to put into place a number of foundations for that. So in the last decade, the College of Policing has been formed, and they want to become a Royal College for Policing in the same way there's a Royal College for Nursing. The College of Policing has defined what it means by evidence-based policing to try to get these 43 fiefdoms that exist in the country working to a consistent script when it comes to developing and using evidence. Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Fire and Rescue Services, the police watchdog, they are also using evidence-based principles, kind of, in their inspection templates. So they are looking for examples of where forces are using it and challenging them when they're not. And increasingly, and this is controversial in the service, the police are introducing a qualifications framework so that all constables will need a degree to enter the service. And if you, constable is the lowest, it's the entry rank for a police officer. I was at a party at the weekend and speaking to a friend of my wife's who is trained to be a nurse and was quite stressed out about a research methods exam they had coming up, and I was quite surprised by the depth of questions that they get on their tests for nursing around the different types of quantitative analysis, the different aspects of randomised control trials, what confidence intervals, these are things that you don't, when I've been to hospital, I wouldn't have necessarily thought that was the type of thing a nurse would use in their day-to-day job. But I when you stop and think about it, okay, I can understand it. And that's where policing is going. That there is a move to get your average typical constable in a position where they can absorb and apply research. At the higher ranks of the service, so the sort of senior management grade would be a superintendent, and then obviously go into sort of executive grades, you will have to have a master's degree to enter that level of the service. So they are trying to sort of push professionalisation from a couple of different aspects, and evidence-based policing and within it algorithms are there. Okay, so far? Okay. So let me just briefly talk about algorithms and AI. I've briefly mentioned facial recognition. This is sort of potential things they might be used for. Police are interested in facial recognition for sort of managing crowds predominantly. Policing football matches is a big deal in this country, and they want to know if certain people are in the crowds. But more relevant to this discussion are triage. How do they pick out, within this massive demand they have coming in non-stop into their contact centres, how do they pick out the cases which are the most serious in a consistent way? How do they plan for where their resources should be, right from who do they recruit to where do they put them? How should they run their day-to-day operations? You know, which individual should they be looking to arrest that day, or seeking to make sure they go and knock on their door to make sure they're not about to do something that they shouldn't be doing? And risk assessment is a major part of policing now, in line with this sort of context of safeguarding that I'm talking about. But they have dozens of different risk assessment processes, and I'll talk a little bit about domestic abuse risk assessment process, which is one of the most embedded. But there is a real need in policing now to determine who is the most risky person, you know, who is most likely to have something harmful happen to them or do something harmful in the future, and then there's real consequence to that judgment. So this is where the services started looking to apply machine learning, artificial intelligence in a sort of broad sense, and just algorithms as a general tool. And of course, this comes with a number of potential pitfalls, and I'll sort of return to these as we go through the examples. But and I've already briefly alluded to them. You know, bias is a major concern, and linked to that is discrimination at one end. I'll make a case in one of these examples, say that bias is not a bad thing, that actually in some cases you do want to be biased towards certain parts of your outcome population that you're trying to target, and I'll illustrate an example like that. Discrimination is a bad thing, I will go that far, and I think there's, as with all of these things, complexity, which means in some cases these sorts of tools could help eliminate discrimination, and in other cases they could absolutely exacerbate the problem. Accuracy is a fundamental pitfall, and this has been a real challenge in some of the tools that have already been rolled out. There are companies, large powerful companies, who want to sell to this market. You know, there's a market of organisations, which is not just in England and Wales, it's around the world. They want to buy these products, these complex products, and it's better if they're off-the-shelf products. And there are companies that will package them as off-the-shelf products. And in this country, there's already been forces that have spent over £1 million on products and then moved away from them because they found they weren't accurate enough. So establishing the accuracy of the models that people are using is an essential pitfall to miss. Transparency, I've already talked about. Morality, you know, that's quite deep and meaningful, but I'll return to that point at the end, I hope. I think the fundamental question here is, if there is the ability to identify somebody who is going to commit a serious crime in the next 2 years, probably, is it, you know, what are the morals around not doing it, not stopping that individual? Obviously the question is, you know, incumbent on that question is, what are the costs of it? You know, how many people am I targeting who are not going to commit that serious crime? But I'll return to that later. That's a major issue that policing has got to confront at some point. I just want to make this distinction, and then I'm going to... Yes?
Can I ask a question about the previous slide?
Yes, please.
What's the difference between bias and discrimination?
So I use bias kind of in the statistical sense of if I'm modelling a population, do I want to move the bias towards a certain outcome? So I'll talk about this a bit in one of the case studies, but do I want to do I want to over sample a bit of the population which has got a certain outcome, so that I can get the result tuned in a certain way? And some models are not building that in. Some of the concerns around bias are that these models will introduce problems from that sort of process. I use discrimination to kind of differentiate where it's more of the argument that liberty of putting forward, where it's these models are embedding discriminatory processes that are already existing in policing. The problem is then defining what those discriminatory processes are, because the argument then is well, so you're saying we've got some discriminatory processes, what are they, why aren't we doing anything about them? But that's never been nailed down.
Sorry, I still haven't understood. Supposing you have a system which decides that it's going to stop and search people with red hair because they're more likely to have much tobacco. In one sense, that's biased towards people with red hair. In another sense, it's accurate because they're more likely to have, supposing that they were more likely to have
tobacco. Yes.
But it's also discriminating against people with red hair.
Yes. Yeah, and the question comes from, what's the evidence base which says they're more likely in the first place? Was it based upon data?
I suppose there is evidence that they are more likely to have, suppose.
Yeah, no, right, now, that's absolutely correct. And you're kind of touching back into the moralistic thing, yeah. Is discrimination in that sense a necessary cost of applying this tool for a greater good? These are incredibly the question is perfect, because this is an incredibly difficult area to manage, and it's very easy to exploit that angle as a problem for these tools as an umbrella term, when actually the devil is always in the detail of the particular scenario that you're looking at.
Because in that particular situation, from a statistical point of view, if there actually is evidence says people with red hair are more likely to have contraband on.
Yes.
Then the algorithm that says that is the case is unbiased.
Correct. But it is discriminating.
But it is discriminating.
Yes.
And you a minute ago said that was a bad thing, and it seems to me to be exactly an appropriate thing if people with red hair are more likely to
have. Yes. But people with red hair, who are a charming group of people, I should say.
Only pick red hair, because I don't think we've got any red hair. Your hair's not really red.
they would quite vocally oppose it, I think. I mean, if you substituted red hair for black skin or Muslim religion, and still there was evidence that, you know, I mean, you take American terrorist attacks, there's strong evidence that most of them are white males, so you know there would be a very vocal opposition to any sort of tool which singled out a group in that way.
From that group, males.
Yes, yeah, or any of those groups. When you're in a world like we are, when we should be, where policing is done by consent, managing relations with the community is got to be a variable that you consider, which you can't factor into the mathematical side of the equation here. It's that's often the sort of breaker that the wave is can't get past. You know, it's police officers or senior police officers particularly are concerned about the effect of supposedly discriminatory tools, whether they're justified by evidence or not. They're concerned about the public outcry, public uncertainty of the applications of those tools. And that is kind of one of the themes I'm sort of want to sort of write large here. We've got to try to educate consumers of law enforcement, define who they are, as to the subtleties of these procedures.
Just to go, I agree with what you're saying. This algorithm identifies correlation, but causality. So, for example, if there is a true correlation with red hair, that's fine. It doesn't mean that there is a causality. There is a compound factor over there.
Oh, sure.
Yes, of course. It's hypothetical. Yes. And you know, one of the major problems with all of these things is there is extremely scarce evidence on causality with policing.
But causality isn't relevant to this, is it?
It's not from a statistical point of view, no, not at all. But from a winning hearts and minds of the public point of view, it is important.
I think discrimination is when you start acting. If you ask people how to sign a
yes, of course.
Is your doubt. This is when it becomes discriminatory for them. You find that life, but it's in the software.
These are exactly the types of debate that are sort of echoed around ethics committees in police forces who are dealing with these sorts of things. And of course, you know, people will say, you know, do you think algorithms are biased? Well, it depends on the algorithm, depends on the procedure it was conceived and what it was trying to do. And then people lose interest because they, you know, I'd like to boil something down to 140 characters. But this is an incredibly complex issue.
If you build a model and you're able to discriminate between, say, two or three groups, let's say colour of hair is one, then if the model is to be believed, you would use those as a discriminating factor, and you would target a particular group. But on the bias side, if the police officers were ignoring the model and just going for, well, I know red-headed people are going to be the problem, I'm going to forget them, well, that to me would be bias. But if the model is ignored, or if the model is believable, then you're able to discriminate on problematic.
Yeah, if you can justify the discrimination on an evidence base, which yeah. I think is extremely rare, then yes. I think that the more common thing is to try to avoid the subject altogether. So a colleague of mine developed a very similar to the one I'll show you, a machine learning algorithm for certain types of offenders, less serious offenders coming into custody, and they would be a few questions into the model, which would then give back a forecast of whether they were likely to commit no offence, a less serious offence, or a serious offence in the next 2 years. And that got up and running. They put it into play with a randomised control trial, and it came under very sharp criticism because one of the variables that was in the model, there were about 30 overall input variables, was the postcode of where the individual lived, which was linked to a socio-demographic classifier from Mosaic, I think it was. And you know, the challenge from the opponents of that is that that was exacerbating prejudice against deprived communities, and there were no evidence for this. They had no evidence that deprived communities were featuring more in the high-risk group and therefore getting adverse attention. But the police force just completely, you know, the throw a wet towel in, get it out, take it out. Might lose 3% in accuracy, it doesn't matter, get it out, the conversation's over. So there's a lot of nervousness about public collateral damage in terms of how it looks around exactly that sort of thing, whereas it might not necessarily be the best forecasting model, but it sates the sort of criticism angles. So I just want to distinguish, I mean, I've been talking about AI and algorithms, and these two terms are confused a lot in policing, and the definitions I put up there are just for show. The first case study I want to sort of run through with you is actually not artificial intelligence or algorithm at all, but very simple statistics which people are saying that's an algorithm, that's artificial intelligence at play, and they're sort of bleeding into this debate overall. So let me return to this issue that we touched upon earlier, where I explained that recorded crime is going up, and a lot of those recorded crimes would have been previously classified as antisocial behaviour and not have an investigation go anywhere. So the police are sort of being swamped with these cases which they're very low probability that they're actually going to bring them to court and prosecute anybody from them. And the effect that's had on the statistics has been you've got offences going up and charges going down, and the overall proportion of charges from offences is even worse, and that of course is what's being reported as an indicator of police performance. The solution that has been proposed and implemented in a couple of forces has been to conduct a case control analysis of these volume, they call them volume crimes because there are lots of them and then they're not serious in the definition. So nobody is psychologically scarred by them, they're not ending up in hospital with no marks on the skin. They're very low level assaults or disturbance of the peace. They have zeroed in or tried to zero in on a case control basis on the factors in these cases which best predict a solved outcome. Okay, so the types of factors they're thinking about are: is there an identified suspect? Is the victim or witness cooperating with us? Is there CCTV? Have we got forensic evidence? Very simplistic, sort of basic things which we were talking about Inspector Morse at dinner, you know, wouldn't even give two thoughts to. They're basic. But in an environment in policing where police officer numbers are going down and the experience base is going down in particular, lots of these types of cases are being processed by inexperienced individuals and quite often not police officers at all. Civilian staff who have been brought in really to process. So the idea that a couple of police forces applied is to try to build a model based on these the predictability of some of these factors that will allow them to forecast whether a case is going to be detected or not, and thereby whether they continue with any investigation in that case. That makes sense? And they have done it in some cases by a logistic regression. The numbers are up there for you to see, but the confusion matrix is really the interesting aspect of this. And they've got a model that works pretty well. And obviously they've been able to adjust the threshold on where they use their exponential here to try to identify different levels of allocation compared to their forecasted solve rate. And what they managed to do in a couple of police forces is develop this into a process which holds their detection performance consistent but substantially pushes down the number of cases that they're allocating out to their experienced specialist detectives who are, you know, sort of valuable resource with increasingly less time. Make sense?
Detective again means solved, yes.
It does, yes, interchangeably used terms. It's detective and solved, yes. And in this case they've been using 1,000 crimes to build the model and then another 1,000 crimes to test the model on that weren't involved in the model building process. And this is described as artificial intelligence, which of course it absolutely is not. In practice, they actually built a very human-centric process around it. So at the top left-hand side of this chart, you have crime reports coming in from the police and the public, which are initially assessed and then assessed for their eligibility for this process, which is known as evidence-based investigation triage, or EBIT for short, and the codes underneath relate to the different types of crime that go into it. They then assess a small number of solvability factors, as I've mentioned, about 8 of them, according to that logistic regression model. And if it goes over a threshold for probability, it will be allocated for investigation because it's likely to be solved.
Sorry, Mark, what was the EBIT stand
for? Sorry, evidence-based investigation triage. If it doesn't meet that threshold, then it gets assessed for public interest or vulnerability. So what that means is an experienced individual will go through the case notes with a checklist. is it somebody who has mental health issues or a repeat victim or is vulnerable in some other sense, or is it a person of public notoriety that we should be dealing with, etc., etc. And they can override the decision of the artificial intelligence and pass it on down the line. They can of course say, look, there's no doesn't meet any of those criteria and we're going to close it. And in fact the majority of cases that get through to that point, they do in fact close. So overriding the model has been infrequent, but has been an important, that part of the process has been critical to convincing their senior stakeholders to actually take it on and adopt it. It's crucial for them to be able to say a human can override this process if need be. This has taken place in a couple of police forces with these sort of less serious violent crimes. Police force I was working in last year tried this with burglary. Randomised control trial of exactly this process, and hadn't even published the results when the Mail on Sunday picked it up and ran this sort of story to challenge that process. No sort of reference to algorithms in the headlines, comes in the body of the report, but this is the narrative, this is a popular populist kind of narrative around the computer says no, you know, isn't it terrible that, you know, mathematical probabilities are overriding subjective individual human decisions, shock horror. And this, to be fair to this force, they've stood by this process and seen it through to the trial, but this is the kind of torpedo they're dealing with in the public environment, and while they're very keen to build in these sorts of administrative overrides. Any questions on any of that?
So what did the randomised control trial show?
I left before they finished it, but it's a colleague of mine who's studying his PhD at Cambridge as well, who's using that randomised control trial for his dissertation, so I'll be able to tell you in a few months, I think. I think certainly in the two police forces who have, they haven't run a randomised control trial with it. They've sort of built filter processes into their system where every 20th case that is selected for closure by the solvability matrix is allocated for investigation anyway. And then after they've got a sufficient sample of those, they will do a sort of quasi-experimental analysis. But they're going to need quite a big sample there so they can meet their baseline assumptions. But
is that what you meant by an RCT?
No, that's not what I meant by an RCT. That's their alternative to an RCT. Yeah. In Norfolk with this is a full RCT. So there'll be randomisation before the matrix is applied. So some cases would go to a business as usual control group with no matrix application. So they had to run it for a very long time to get their sample sizes up to what they needed to get the statistics out.
Professional judgment.
Yeah.
Having the algorithm.
Yeah, basically. And of course, you know, in that process, professional judgment is still there. It's still there. I mean, but it's, you know, it's like a life raft that I've got to cling to. And I may sound sceptical. The pragmatist in me knows that that's essential, not just for winning public trust or professional trust in it, but you know the expertise in the service of developing these types of tools is immature at the moment. So it's an important control. The second case study I want to talk about is machine learning, and this is returning to this issue of safeguarding, which I've talked about, and domestic abuse in particular. So police forces are, you know, nationwide, they're dealing with thousands of individuals a day, and many of them for potentially dangerous crimes. And there's this, you know, I touched upon it earlier with the issue of risk assessment. You know, how do they determine who poses the most risk in the future? At the moment, you have a multitude of different tools to do that, depending on the circumstance. So there's a different risk of different risk of domestic abuse tool to a child sexual exploitation tool to a general acquisitive crime offending tool. Each force will do that slightly differently and apply it differently. So if I get arrested in Cambridgeshire, I might have one tool applied to me. If I then go over the border into Bedfordshire, I might get something completely different. So the public are getting very different service given to them in those two forces. I want to talk specifically about domestic abuse. National surveys have shown there's 2 million victims of domestic abuse in this country every year, but only 600,000 crimes get recorded by the police forces in the country, which is still a lot. Of those 600,000, 130 are homicides, and more than that will be rapes or serious assaults where there's a serious injury inflicted, but it's still a very, very low proportion of overall domestic abuse. At the government's mandate, the police response to domestic abuse is very strong. They attend any report of domestic abuse. There's never a question of, well, there should never be a question of a police officer not coming to see you, whether you want them to or not. And if when they get there, they judge that they have the power of arrest, they are obliged to use that power of arrest, whether you want your partner arrested or not. They will fill out with each victim a 30-35 question risk assessment, and if they come to you twice, they'll do it twice, and three times, they'll do it three times. And then that goes to a domestic abuse specialist who does it again with the case notes and goes over it again. If you come out of that risk assessment process as a high-risk case, which about a third of their cases do, then you get referred to a multi-agency risk assessment conference where other public agencies sit round and discuss the case, and they might discuss housing or probation or etc. 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 However, targeting research has shown that of the serious cases that are reported to police, half of them were previously unknown for any form of domestic abuse. The police had no chance of predicting those cases, because they just hadn't got any domestic foreknowledge. They may have known about the cases for another reason, but they wouldn't have conducted their domestic abuse risk assessment, because they only instigate that in domestic abuse cases. So they've got a major challenge, which potentially a machine learning model might be able to address. So this is the sort of challenge that's been picked up to identify what type of method could forecast these relatively rare outcomes from a much larger population, and then sort of inform practice. And in this example, I'm going to talk about random forests. Have any of you worked with random forests? Good, I can say what I like. Is there really? Okay. I mean, random forests are, they're a classification regression model, decision trees, and they work basically by constructing multiple iterations of these decision trees by selecting a random number of parameters, which you can, a random number of variables which you can specify as a parameter in your model building process, and then learning about the probability, the success rate of its predictions in each of those models. And then it uses a majority voting system. So every tree in the model gets a vote in the overall forecast, and the winning category becomes the overall forecast of the model. This is kind of favoured at the moment in criminology, above some other, certainly above some of the other regression models, but particularly for the classification tree aspect, because you can leverage, I mean, police have more data than they know what to do with, and you can chuck it all into a random forest model. You don't need to, you don't necessarily need to be particularly discriminatory, to use the term adversely, about what you're selecting, of course, unless you want to avoid being discriminatory, in which case you might, and have done in some cases, taking them out. And none of those variables need to have an identified causal or even correlation-based relationship to the outcome variable that you're predicting. Now, the third point up there is important, back to the earlier question about bias and my sort of ham-fisted answer to you. The parameters that you can enter into a random forest model will allow you to deliberately skew the forecasts in a direction. So when it's sampling records to build the trees, you can tell it to oversample from a certain outcome to build the models. So you can deliberately bias your model towards a certain aspect. The other major advantage of random forest is it runs a technique called out-of-bag sampling. So it partitions its data sample that it's building its model on into two-thirds in each tree, and this will be done differently for each tree that it builds. It will partition about two-thirds of the data to train the model and then reserve a third to test that against. And that's how it learns how it's getting better every time. And then it will run a sort of iterative process like this. So across the horizontal axis you've got the number of the cumulative number of trees that this model has been running, and then the error rate and predictions on the vertical axis. And you can see it sort of stabilizes in this case around sort of just after 100 trees. So there's some good tuning parameters in random forest where you can sort of cut down your processing time, because actually if I'm running more than 100 iterations of trees after this, which is quite a lot of computational power that it's sucking up, it's not really adding any marginal benefit. In this case, let me just explain the legend. The zeros, so in this model, what I've been looking to try and do is take any individual that is arrested and comes into a police custody suite, and try to predict whether they will commit no domestic abuse in the next 2 years. That's zero, the code zero, the red line. A non-serious domestic abuse crime in the next 2 years, that's number one, or a serious domestic abuse crime in the next 2 years, that's two, the blue line. So the objective at the sort of outset of this model is to try to zero in on those cases which are likely to come to likely to encounter again for a serious domestic crime, and that may enable forces to target those individuals in a different way. It also doesn't solve the question of what you would do with those individuals, it just puts a tab up.
How does it handle missing data? Enormous amounts of data, but I'm guessing that the data sets are not complete.
That's a relevant point, Martin. Random forests are not great at missing data, so you're sort of faced with your usual options. Impute, depends on how many are missing. In this model, anything that had missing data went out. Now, what obviously I haven't done extensively, when you're working with 50 data variables in this, there's not the time necessary to go through and validate whether the data is what it says it is, so you're kind of taking it as read. That's a crucial part of the process. You put rubbish in, you'll get rubbish out in terms of the general data quality, but as a rule with these, missing data of any notable proportion, get it out and stick a dummy back in.
So there is a chance then that there could be some significant individuals who've got missing data.
Yes.
Who will not be picked up.
Yes. They're not taken out at the record level, as in taking out the individuals, it's taken out at the variable level. So if, say, I had gender and every third gender woman, so I'd lose gender as a variable rather than lose the case. Much more complex confusion matrix to show you as a result of this, and I'll just take some time to sort of pick through this, if that's okay. So let me just remind you here. The forecasting runs vertically down the table, and the actual results of the cases run horizontally across the table. So in this column here are all of the cases where the model, the random forest model, predicted that there would be no domestic abuse in the next 2 years. So if you then read that down the table, 23,977 forecasts of no domestic abuse actually had no domestic abuse. 42 had non-serious domestic abuse and 2 had serious domestic abuse. So the false negative rate there is pretty tight, it's pretty low. There you've got the non-serious, and then you've got the serious ones, which is kind of where we started the question here. And in this case, it's interesting because you've got 3,700, you know, overall there's 5,500 forecasts of serious domestic abuse in this population, and actually the vast majority of them are wrong. 94% of them are wrong. 3,765 actually never came to any attention for domestic abuse. But if you read across from DD2 on the actual, the lower line of the table, this model predicted 81% of all the actual serious domestic abuse cases. So it's not missing, you know, it's not missing a high proportion of them. It's just creating a lot of false positives to get that accuracy up. Now that ratio of false positives is actually not any worse than what forces are currently achieving without anything like an 81% positive predicted. Their predictive validity, I mean, is nowhere near 81% of cases. That makes sense.
This is what you meant by the bias that you want. So you want more.
Absolutely.
You don't want the false negatives at all.
That's right.
You are happy to accept a few false positives.
That's right. So you've hit it nail on the head. So in the top corner there, what we would describe as wasteful errors. They're putting an intervention into place when they didn't need to. What they really, really don't want are the harmful ones, where they're predicting no domestic abuse and go on to have a serious case. So in the tuning parameters for the model, we change the bias of the sample to overcompensate for those serious cases. So we're predicting more serious, but at a tolerable error rate. Now, that has to be a management executive decision, because each organisation is going to have a different policy on this.
What did the corresponding table look like for the humans
doing it? I haven't run that analysis. There are other studies that have been done, but I mean, by virtue of the fact that of the research that has been done that shows half of serious domestic abuse cases were not previously known, shows you there was no chance of prediction. So it's at least 50% that they weren't predicted.
But that might just mean that they haven't set their, the humans haven't set their bias, their threshold.
They haven't even assessed them for domestic abuse at all, because the current practice is only to risk assess known domestic abuse cases. This is anyone who's arrested for anything. So
not random members of the public.
No. That would be challenging. this is anyone who's been arrested. And the predictor variables are predominantly relating to their offending history. So how many years this type of crime have they committed, and how long has it been since then? but what this potentially adds an advantage to policing is a much wider screening tool with enhanced accuracy over there at the moment, currently much narrower and resource intensive screening tool. The real question, though, that you touched on is, you know, in this case, if you ran this, you'd have 3,765 individuals who are receiving something. This doesn't specify what. When actually there was no case for this. We know that we're going to be wrong in 94% of the cases, but we're going to get 80% of the serious cases. Is that justifiable? Can you afford to do it? I mean, it depends on what type of intervention you're putting into place. And these are the challenges that face police agencies at the moment. So I just finish off. Am I okay for time? Am I okay for time? With a few rhetorical questions which you may want to discuss or tell me to go home. You know, there's a real, I mean, policing is still very much founded on professional judgment and celebrates professional judgment, and that's a good thing. But there is no tool out there which can predict 80% of serious domestic abuse cases from a sample, and you know, a human couldn't hope to. Go on.
I don't think you've given us evidence for that, because if the police, if I understood you right,
yes,
if the police before had bothered to consider the question of whether or not everybody they arrested was going to commit domestic abuse, they might have done equally well.
Yes, okay, that's a fair challenge. And it possibly links to the point that I was going to make, that they wouldn't have the scope to do that. So from an efficiency perspective, at least, this offers a viable way to screen a wider population of individuals than they currently can. That's more of an, I think, more of an accurate statement, and that's a fair challenge. The question is, from an ethical perspective, should they do that? You know, is there a moral case for treating individuals who've never presented for domestic abuse in a different way because a tool like this predicts that they will? There are mechanical questions that the police face around whether they can do it, both from an infrastructure perspective, but probably more pertinently from an expertise perspective, and whether they have the individual expertise within their organisations to be able to refine these tools and use them in a responsible way. I mean, I've given you one or two examples here, but one of real artificial intelligence use. And it's a specialist area. It goes beyond the domains of your common or garden police practitioner. And there's a challenge there. And then finally, you know, it's very easy to sort of put a wrap around all of these problems by saying, well, we need regulation. There has to be regulation in police use of algorithms. And that's a very sound idea. But coordinating that into a sort of formal structure of oversight is a big step. I'd be interested to hear what you think about how that goes on in your own areas, or how it might go on in this one. That's it. Those are all my slides, and I'll stop there.
Americans judges or judiciary didn't like the artificial intelligence because of defendants.
Oh no, the opposite actually. The opposite. They did. The defendants tried to use the fact that it was a black box method.
Right.
So the if I remember correctly, and you forgive me for not being able to cite the exact case because I've heard it a number of times. The defendant had been sentenced based partially on the recommendations of a machine learning risk assessment tool. They tried to challenge the length of their sentence on the basis that it was a black box method and that they couldn't challenge it,
yep,
because they couldn't scrutinise it, and the judge kicked it out.
And the second question was, I remember 30 years ago or more, I had a PhD research student looking at familial factors in pregnancy complications with the Aberdeen Maternity Database, which at the time was the second largest in the world. Are there any familial factors included in any of your models? I'm thinking of the domestic abuse side, because in my naivety, abuse can lead to abuse in the family line.
Yes.
And is that a plan to be built in?
I mean, and this is probably the promise of this type of modelling, that there's a lot of room for improvement. At the moment, the model that I've shown you there is configured only on offending history known to the particular police force that I have the data, so it doesn't even go beyond their own boundaries. I think there's probably a meritable hypothesis to be tested that expanding into other databases such as familial issues, or pick one, but, you know, that should really only improve the accuracy. And that's kind of the thing with random forests is, if you add more, it's not going to penalise you. It's only going to improve the accuracy that you've got. So, yeah.
I'm very interested in, you know, this Judge Mental trial that's going on, because, you know, we've seen it does quite well. There's a bias there, but we're very interested in seeing the results of the trial with the usual Judge Mental.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, it's we seen anecdotally that this is similar to the Judge Mental.
Yes.
Anecdotally, so I suppose we then have to think, well, is it actually doing anything? Are we, is it with police numbers going down, is it actually going to say help the police, you know, replace manpower a bit?
I mean, that's kind of the context that it's, you know, they're trying to bring some of these tools in on that premise, that it will free capacity somehow, because they'll be able to focus on what they've got left, on the things that matter the most. But that's an awfully broad brush sentiment, and it's there's a lot of challenges to that. Especially when you put so many escape valves into the process, and you can include this case because I've just got a feeling about it. You know, you can lose that purpose quite quickly.
Because you've still got somebody involved. You always probably have to have someone involved, but you might. The thing is, with numbers going down, you sort of have to think about how you can.
Yes, you do.
These things
you do.
Could become important.
And you've got to. You've also got to make sure that you don't sort of create robots by using robots. Yeah. You know, and people lose their intuition because they've got this nice tool which says high risk or low risk. So that
algorithm take over, and you start believing the algorithm more. You start not thinking,
it could then become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's a real challenge. Yeah. That oversight, again, back to the oversight, back to the ability of forces to sort of regulate themselves on these things. They're going to have to build that capacity into the system somewhere. My favourite, I mean, I don't know how it goes on in other professions, if it goes on, but my favourite would be a national oversight that sort of was able to establish principles that, and then check and balance that forces came up to scratch on them, or help them self-assess. But it's complex.
It's outside of your research, so perhaps unfair, obviously, but in the RCT that looked at whether a particular intervention directed the police there helped,
yes.
Was there any consideration of the dispersal kind of effect?
Yes, yes, in lots of them, because it's the first thing, it's the first challenge that comes out. They call it displacement in the literature. By and large, the effect, and I'm generalising, I think it's Anthony Braga who wrote this systematic review on this, the general trend is that crime in surrounding areas goes down as well, and actually there's a positive effect by visibility in a certain within a certain radius. But it does, again, it's context specific, so it depends what the police officer's doing. They're just going to sit in their car and read a newspaper, no effect. Where they go into areas and they sort of call it problem solving in police nomenclature, but they're looking to be proactive around solving issues that are around them, which might involve other agencies and, you know, cleaning up the environment and so on and so forth. Or where they come in, they've got a maximum window of 15 minutes before they become part of the furniture and people just generally ignore them. And that's been established through through RCTs as well. So what they do in the hotspots matters. So it's not, this is where policing and medicine particularly differ. The external validity of studies is more of a challenge to generalise them to all the populations. But that's the strongest area that policing has evidence in.
You raised the point about professional judgment being treasured greatly. The objectively.
Yeah.
Is there a balancing argument to be trying to put forward? Well, there is a black box in the policeman's head, at least you can look at the algorithm. I'm not saying that's easy, but
yeah.
There are counter narratives.
There definitely is. It's actually my favourite one to go to. When people talk about discrimination in these more possible discrimination in these models. I think there's a... Intuition has the weight of history behind it, and it's the default position. So it's in the box seat, and you can put a police officer in a witness box and question them. And it's sometimes harder to do that with... a complex black box algorithm. But there's definitely a counterweight to that argument, which is an algorithm is at least going to apply itself consistently to a situation, whereas different police officers, as with all different human beings, will do things in different ways and might not necessarily be able to understand why they did them in those ways. To touch upon the gentleman's point earlier, there's not been a great deal of studies done about the consistency of police judgments. So that counter-argument does lack an evidence base behind it, to the same extent, really, that attacking algorithms for exacerbating bias does. Yes, sir?
In his algorithms that are constructed on retrospective data,
yes,
which are probably dictated by the procedures which are happening,
yes.
How therefore can these algorithms dictate what might
be checked? That's a real issue. The data has to be kept. Police procedures change all the time. The law changes all the time. Cultural norms in the organisations will change all the time. So, you can't build algorithms on 30 years of data for modern purposes. They've got to be based on contemporary data to the circumstance, fitted to the circumstance that you're building your model for. But it is a big, there is a big flaw in that. That's probably one of the biggest weaknesses in this, is you've got to build them on those data. That's what you've got available. So in that extent, that's all where criticism is always going to be there.
Surely have to keep updating the model based on throwing away the out-of-date data, basically,
You do, and again there you're into real, because if you're operationalizing the model and it's then becoming self, so it's working with its own predictions after a while. So none of them are really mature enough to have sort of lived through that life cycle yet. The oldest iterations that we're working with are sort of 8 or 9 years old, and have been rolled out slowly, so they can still sort of bring in populations to test them on, which were not used to grow them, if you like. But that's definitely something the field has got to look at.
The slides will be going in the web with that submission. Hopefully the audio has come out as well. But I can see this is going to run and run. This is just the start of it. What a moral issue here. But thank you very much, Matt.
You're very welcome. Thank you for listening.